Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we focus on in this show. We talk about strategies, and I share blueprints and ideas. I share some of those big, epic mistakes I've made along the way. I interview different experts in the field, all because I know that teachers are vital in helping students have voice and choice in their learning and develop that creative potential. And before we get started, I just want to share a word from our sponsor. Just kidding, it's going to be multiple words, because if it was one word, it wouldn't be an advertisement. So, multiple words from our sponsor. Here we go. Teachers, do you need to identify instructional gaps, provide personalized learning paths, and track learning progress to mastery for students? Then listen up. McGraw-Hill has an adaptive learning program called ALEX, and it has already helped millions of students. ALEX is an online math and science program for grades 3 through 12 that will inspire confidence and yield measurable results. With dynamic learning paths and real-time feedback, ALEX can be used for intervention, acceleration, and enrichment. Get 2 months free at mheonline.com/math1. That's MHE for McGraw-Hill Education. Online.com/math1. ALEX has already helped millions of kids. Check it out today and see if it's the tool you need to help your students. Don't miss out on the opportunity for 2 free months only at mheonline.com/math1. That's MHE for McGraw-Hill Education. Online.com/math1. So today I'm going to be talking about this idea of content curation. Content curation is a vital part of the creative process, and we're going to explore why it matters and how it works. When we think about creativity, it's easy to picture a person coming up with something entirely new, pulling it from thin air and making it from scratch. But if you watch people engaged in creative work, they are often critical consumers of the same type of work that they create. There's this ongoing cycle of critical consuming, inspiration, and creative work. And as they create more, it leads to a deeper ability to consume critically, where they then find more inspiration, and this cycle continues again of critical consuming, inspiration, and creative work. Now, I actually explored this idea in a sketch video. Again, if you've never checked out my YouTube channel, you'll find it at spencervideos.com. You can find the sketch video about it. But, you know, this is the core idea that critical consuming leads to creativity. Now, if we think about it this way, chefs enjoy great meals. Musicians listen to great music. Engineers make sense out of what other people have designed. In fact, I once went to an amusement park with my father-in-law and, of course, our family, and he just never stopped trying to figure out how all the roller coasters worked and the rides worked, and he could not shut off the engineering part of his brain. It's part of what he loved about going to a theme park. And the better they are at consuming, the better and more creative they'll likely be in terms of inspiration to create something new. So the best makers and creators are often the best consumers of what they create. So then if we want students to be makers, we need students to be critical consumers. However, we live in a world of instant information where ideas go viral without much thought regarding accuracy or validity. It's a place where content is cheap, cheap to make, cheap to share, cheap to consume, and the traditional gatekeepers are gone, which is great for students. They can create and share their work in ways that were previously unimaginable. But there's also a cost. The best stuff doesn't always rise to the top. And if we're not careful, we mistake the the speed of consumption for the depth of knowledge. And this is why we need students to learn the art of curation. So what is content curation? In recent years, we've seen the rise in popularity of a group of bloggers who specialize in content curation. Think of Brain Pickings, Farnham Street, Open Culture. Those are all basically curation blogs in different ways. In a world of information saturation, curation has become a critical skill. In fact, I was just at a baseball game for my kids the other day, and I'm talking to a dad, and he said, you know, what are you reading? We started talking about it, and he said, oh, I'm reading Daily Stoic. And Daily Stoic is a great example of curating something really old, but finding those relevant parts from old Stoic philosophers and making it relevant to now. That's the core idea of curation. But it's important to recognize that curation goes beyond simply collecting items online. The best curators know how to find what is best by immersing themselves in a niche area while also making surprising connections between ideas in seemingly unrelated worlds. Curators find specific excerpts that are relevant at the moment, but also timeless. They can explain the purpose, the context, and the necessity of the information that they are citing. I'm drawn toward an archaic definition of this term, curation. It originally had a much more earthy, even gritty connotation. And some linguists tie it back to the medieval Latin word curare, which means to cure an illness. It had a connotation of providing a loving attention and management. Other linguists tie the word curator back to the word curatus, which meant spiritual guide or one responsible for the cure of the souls. Either way, I love those definitions. I love this idea of curing an illness or being a guide or caring for the soul. I think that that's what curation truly is all about. It is deeply, deeply human. Over time, this word morphed into a deep care and love for a particular subject, knowledge, or set of artistic works. Think of art curators who define the spaces of a museum. They know the works on a deep level and can explain the meaning and purpose in ways that make the work more relevant. Some of the best curators are able to tap into the original sense of being, you know, one responsible for the care of the souls. They care not only for what the work means, but for how it will make you a better person when you interact with it. And it has me thinking, you know, as educators, as teachers, this is who we are. This is what we do. We help students grow in wisdom. We are curators. But that's also what we want for our students. We want them to have both an excited passion and a nuanced care for what they are learning. We want them to pay attention to context and purpose in the information that they consume. We want them to make connections and provide their own lens to what they find. So what does curation actually look like? Well, the best curators are the ultimate geeks. They nerd out on key ideas, movements, information, and artistic works. Whether it's a painting or a mathematical process, they find joy in the process of discovery and they love to tell you about it. They are, on one hand, critics, but also evangelists. While there is an overlap with criticism, curators are more likely to geek out on the subject in a way that is, well, kind of explanatory instead of evaluative. This is often combined with a desire to make the work more accessible to the public. On some level, both curators and critics are gatekeepers of information. However, while critics are often shutting the gates, curators are often the ones opening the gates and convincing people to come inside. A true curator is both a fan and a critic. And there's this constant overlap of celebrating the work, but also critiquing it at the same time. If all of this might seem abstract, well, here are a few ideas about the curation process. It starts with searching for the content. The best curators are the ones who can find content that no one else is noticing, right? Then there's geeking out on the content. The best curators are able to collect and consume great content, and it's not mindless consumption. It is mindful and relaxed, but also sharp and analytical. One of the best things that I've noticed with, you know, great curators is that they scribble notes all over the margins of books, and yet they feel the complete freedom to just skim and skip when necessary as well. They know how to not just search for content, but find the content that actually matters. And that then leads into organizing content. Curation often involves placing content into categories or themes. Often students will try to figure out the right way to organize the information because schools typically teach students an external organizational system. However, this sense of classification is deeply personal and should mirror the way students think. We want them to organize the information on their own. It's a chance to engage in tagging and categorizing in a way that feels deeply meaningful to students. As this happens, it will naturally lead to the next step where they go from organizing the content to making connections. The best curators are able to find connections between seemingly opposite artists, ideas, or even disciplines in ways that make you think, dang, I have never considered that before. How did I miss that? Another thing that happens is that they find trends. This aspect of curation is a little more analytical. Sometimes it even involves picking apart data or crunching numbers. It's the idea of looking at information across several spaces and finding specific trends. And this is often where someone arrives at a conclusion that is, well, counterintuitive. The other thing that they do as they begin to make connections and they've already organized content looking for trends is they begin to add a unique lens. Curators rarely write in-depth explanations of the content. There's typically a certain clarity and brevity in the commentary that they add. You want students to learn how to sort of add the commentary with a very subtle, light touch. When done well, a curator almost seems invisible, moving along the snippets of the content in a way that draws you in. And yet, over time, you begin to appreciate the subtle personality and voice of a curator. If the critic and commentator sometimes falls victim to shouting out their opinions, the curator is gently whispering a relevant idea to a distracted culture. And then finally, there's this place where they are sharing the content. Content curation has the end goal of getting great content into the hands of a larger audience. It is deliberately others-centered, even when the curator is, well, kind of introspective. Sometimes the goal is to provide a set of practical information into the hands of readers. Others are more about offering something intriguing, even if it's not inherently practical. But whatever it may be, the goal is to provide something relevant to an audience. So how do we get started with content curation? Well, number one, model the curation process. So students actually need to learn how to engage in curation. It's not going to necessarily come natural to them. What this looks like is going to vary. You know, it may be that you have students keep journals where they curate information. It may be that they keep their information on spreadsheets or shared documents. They might use visual curation tools. I love the idea of starting with a private journal and really allowing it to be deeply personal and then moving to a place where they share it with a larger audience. When I taught middle school, students often created curiosity casts where they would ask a question, find information, and then they would share their findings in a series of podcasts. That was sort of a curation process. It could also be a short presentation or video that they create, or they might go with a more literal example of curation. And you can have students create, you know, museums where they find primary and secondary sources, and they display the information in an interesting way, and they invite the community to show up to it. All right, idea number two is to let students geek out. We've talked about this a lot, but curators are natural geeks. They get excited about ideas and topics within their domain. They engage in research in a way that feels like an adventure. Recently, a couple podcasts ago, I talked about geek out blogs. That is a great way to begin. And the key is to let them choose whatever topic they want, and then to help them figure out what information matters the most, how they can tie it to other disciplines and domains. Along the way, it can create more buy-in and it can improve engagement. And as a teacher, you can encourage students to go deeper in their topics by asking critical thinking questions and encouraging students to see how their topics connect to various systems, ideas, communities. You're really getting them to think deeply about whatever topic they're into. And this is really a great way to help students gain empathy because they will share it with an audience. And this could be fashion, Minecraft, TikTok videos, whatever it may be. But what you're getting at is helping them go through the curation process and figure out how to think deeply about what they're finding and how they're going to share it with others. Idea number three, spend more time on it. Content curation, quite simply, takes time. Take a look at any master curator and you will see a commitment to time. There's no way around it. If you want to see students curate, you have to carve out time. But we can integrate curation into the daily process of information consumption and analysis. This can feel challenging in certain subjects where we feel the time crunch and the need to cover plenty of content. However, the curation process is often about how students will find, organize, and select the information, how they'll analyze it, how they'll share it with others. And they can engage in curation as they read secondary and primary sources in social studies, or as they read informational texts or, you know, watch videos about concepts and ideas in science. And they can then, you know, curate it and share it with others. I mean, they can curate math strategies and compare and contrast processes. We did curation of beautiful graphs. It was basically if you found a graph or, and it sounds odd, but a diagram or graph that was beautiful, intriguing, fascinating, and we collected these as a class, and it was an ongoing curation kind of math in our world. Students can curate, research information that they find in their ELA class, whatever it may be. So the goal is to devote some time to this. And I want to point out that, you know, this might seem like, you know, how are we going to find the time to do this? There's, you know, we're already crunched for time. But that leads to thought number four, which is to begin earlier. Traditionally, teachers wait until the end of the year to have students do research. It's often a multi-week, even a multi-month project that they'll do. But if you begin at the beginning of the year, students will slowly learn the art of curation as the year progresses. So going back to this idea of the time crunch, you are essentially scrapping the big research project that you might do at the end of the year, and instead you're integrating research, curation, and communication into multiple unit plans that you're designing. So it becomes more of a habit rather than just, you know, a deep dive process that they get into at the very end. All right, then, and the final one, number five, is to let students own the process. They should choose the topics, the questions, and the sources they find interesting. This could connect to research, silent reading, blogging, Genius Hour. It's also important to let them choose the platforms that they use. Curation can happen in a journal or a notebook if they want to keep it private, or it can happen in a blog, in a podcast, or in a video series. In some cases, you might use something like Pinterest or other visual curation site so that students can organize things in a visual and spatial manner. So those are the five ideas for getting started. The key thing is you are already a curator. Now, what do I mean by that? People often say things like, well, the teacher is no longer the source of information now that students can curate it themselves. And this is typically accompanied by the term guide on the side to describe your role as a teacher. Now, while I see some validity in this sentiment, I actually think that it proves that now more than ever, teachers need to be curators. They need to be geeking out on their subjects. They need to help students figure out where to go. Yes, they might be the guide on the side, but they're still guides. That's still the word. Helping students navigate the terrain for the first time ever. And often a teacher will curate a series of information first that students will access before they go off-road on their own. And that's precisely what a curator does. We curate so that we can help students learn the art of content curation as well. Teachers are natural curators. We piece together resources, research, and ideas as we develop lessons. We curate the content that we teach. This isn't anything new or groundbreaking. It's what happens when we find a great book or video or podcast and we share it with our students. But what if we take this art of curation and teach it to our students as well? What if we empower students to curate their own content so that they become not only lifelong learners, but lifelong curators? Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a huge favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.